There's a better world that's a-coming, tell you why. There's a better world that's a-coming, tell you why. We will beat 'em on the land, on the sea and in the sky. There's a better world that's a-coming, tell you why. There's a better world that's a-coming, don't you see? When we'll all be union and we'll all be free. There's a better world that's a-coming, don't you see?
Good evening, friends. This is your host, News Director Rick Spezak, with another Progressive News Network. We've got some wonderful guests tonight. We've got Diana Demarest, Democratic strategist and campaign consultant. Emine Dilik, publisher of Progressive Press. Also, since she's living overseas, we got a report from her from Madrid. We've also got Dennis Campbell, producer of The Worldview on the YouTube channel, and also publisher of the UK Progressive, who brings us his insights from across the big water also. He is based in the Wales area of the UK. We've also got Susan Booker of the Palm Beach County Supervisor of Elections, keeping you informed on the ongoing chase for the verification of voters, also known as the Republican voter purge. They never met a Democratic voter. They actually wanted to have record their vote. And then, of course, because it's been a big weekend for Democrats here in the state of Florida, Frank Day, a Democratic leader and chairman from the northern part of the state, will give us a report later in the evening from the recently concluded convention in Orlando. Lots of good news there as well. So first, these news stories. Dianne Feinstein, a member of the Senate Committee of the U.S. Senate and a lawmaker, says she supports the NSA and its ongoing surveillance programs. The agency has faced many allegations after Edward Snowden and has released documents showing that the NSA has been spying on the telephonic data of millions and millions and millions here in the U.S. and, of course, overseas as well. The State Weekly reports that Feinstein gave a statement while talking to Wall Street Journal that if the surveillance programs of the NSA had been in motion before that, the 9/11 incident would have been prevented. Of course, she forgets all those interesting reports like the one that Condoleezza Rice was forced to admit to, that Osama bin Laden's got planes headed for the U.S. And, the Pentagon, who... and never met a terrorist they didn't want to fund. They scratched off a former employee, Saddam. They scratched off the former employee of the Taliban. And, of course, Assad is on again, off again, an employee of our government. But now, evidently, we're not going to attack him, so he's must be back in our good graces. God only knows what deal is keeping him on the old leash. Mark Udall and Ron Wyden, who are members of the Senate Committee for Intelligence, have criticized the NSA's Keith Alexander by writing a letter which says, saying that these programs have disrupted dozens of potential terrorist plots is misleading if the bulk of phone records collection program is actually providing little or no value. They also provide a detail that only a few terrorist plots have been avoided. We have been listening in to the president of Brazil and Angela Merkel of Germany and, of course, the president of Mexico. But that on their private cell, we think there's not much chance they're talking to terrorists. What do you think? The Guardian has also published a report that Senator Dianne Feinstein is anticipating a plan to introduce legislation which would punish all those who make any critical statements against the NSA. So criticism is not going to be allowed and could be punishable by, drumroll, a sentence. And that sentence is not what we're talking about. Okay, fracking activists silenced for doing the EPA's work. This is a story by former contributor Walter Brash. This was for Buzz Flash at Truth Out. Monday, October 21st, Vera Scroggins, a retired real estate agent and nurse's aide, was in common pleas court for Susquehanna, Pennsylvania, to explain why a temporary injunction shouldn't be introduced against her. Before her were four lawyers and several employees of Cabot Gas and Oil, who do no wrong, who accused her of trespassing and causing irreparable harm, probably by staying on her own front porch, to the company that is almost $1 billion in revenue of 2012. They didn't want her on their property that they owned or leased in the Marcellus Shale. Scroggins, an anti-fracking activist, you know, one of those people that like would like to protect your drinking water, someone who not only knows what is happening in the gas fields northeast Pennsylvania, but willingly devotes much of her day to helping others to see and understand the damage that fracking causes. Since 2010, she has led visitors, government officials, and journalists on tours of the gas fields to rigs and well pads, pipelines, compressor stations, and roads damaged by the heavy volume of truck traffic necessary to build and support the wells. As part of her tour, she introduces visitors to those affected by fracking. To the people of northeastern Pennsylvania, who've seen their air and water polluted, their health impacted. Visitors come from New York, which has a moratorium on fracking, from Pennsylvania, which doesn't, from surrounding states, and from foreign countries who want to see what fracking is and what does it do. She's now in a courtroom in Montrose, accused of trespassing, and she's forced to defend herself. My God, showing people what it looks like. That's clearly pretty inflammatory, huh? So she asked Judge Kenneth Siemens for a continuance. She explained she only received by mail the papers the previous Thursday and was told she had 20 days to respond. She explained on Friday to a sheriff's deputy who came to her house with copies of the same papers that ordered her court 3 days. She explained she had tried to secure an attorney but was unable to do so over the weekend. Judge Siemens told her he couldn't grant a continuance because she didn't give the court 24-hour notice. So if she'd only give them notice that she didn't have, he could have stopped it. He said that to grant a continuous would inconvenience three of the attorneys who'd come all the way from Pittsburgh, and I might have to pay their fees if the hearing was delayed. So with that price in mind, he just couldn't help her get justice. So in 4 hours, Cabot called several witnesses, employees, security personnel, and subcontractors to testify they saw this woman trespassing. They claimed her presence presented safety risks. What we've seen is an increase in frequency and also the number of visitors she's putting in harm's way, Cabot's George Stark told Stacy Wilson of the Susquehanna County Independent. In her defense, Scroggins called three friends who accompanied her to court. They testified she was always polite and never posed a safety risk. She says when she went to a Cabot location, she always reported to the security or field office, never received any written warnings or demands in the 2 years she was at those sites. When I was asked to leave, I left, she said. Cabot personnel replied, she was never a visitor, even though she claimed she had amicable chats with on-site managers since 2009. They claimed she was on company-owned access roads. She replied she primarily used public roads, and at times her car or chartered bus might have been on an access road. They never blocked them, unlike the gas industry vehicles that often keep drivers bottled up in traffic jams or set times when residents can't even use public roads, even leading to their own homes because of heavy frack truck traffic. I was blocked after going on sites and access roads several times since 2009 and kept up to an hour, she said, but then they allowed me to leave. No police were called. If I'm trespassing, then charge me, she remembers saying. Cabot has never charged her nor sent her any written demands to cease her visits. For Cabot personnel, it has to be frustrating to have to deal with what they may have thought was a nosy pest who kept showing up at their worst sites, possibly endangering herself, her guests, or the workers. For Scroggins, she was there explaining drilling to many who have never seen a rig or a well pad, videotaping what was the truth about Cabot's operations in the fracking in the Marcellus Shale. In court, she tried several times to explain she had documented health and safety violations at Cabot sites, many of which led to fines and citations. She tried to explain that she has put hundreds of videotapes online or at YouTube to show the damage the company and other companies are doing to the people. Every time she tried to present the evidence, a Cabot lawyer objected, and the judge struck the testimony from the record. Clearly, this is very even-handed. Let me go on to another story. I think you get the drift of that. Lies that will kill America. Here in Manhattan the other day, you couldn't miss it. The big, bold headlines across the front page of the tabloid New York Post screamed in one of those sick, slick lies that are the trademark of Rupert Murdoch. Morlock. Right-wing media empire. There he was, Uncle Sam brandishing a revolver and wearing a burglar mask. Uncle Scam, U.S. robs my bank of $13 billion. Say what? Pure hogwash. And Murdoch's minions know it. That $13 billion is the settlement that J.P. Morgan and Chase, the country's biggest bank, negotiated with the government to settle its own ripoff of American homeowners and investors. These shady practices that 5 years ago helped trigger the financial meltdown, including manipulating mortgages and selling millions of Americans into bankruptcy or foreclosure. If anyone's been robbed, it's not J.P. Morgan, which can absorb the loss and probably take a tax write-off for at least part of it. Let me go on. This is disgusting. Next, Harry Reid, no grand bargain in the near future. No, they promised they're not going to try to gut Social Security, and you can count on them. That fiery speaker, Harry Reid, boy, I'll tell you, he sets a standard. Troubling trade deal on the horizon. Have you heard about the Trans-Pacific Partnership, TPP? You've heard about it here. Free trade agreement? Well, if you're not, you're not alone. The American people, by design, know very little about what U.S. negotiators are promising in closed-door talks with Australia, Brunei, Canada, Chile, Mexico, New Zealand, Peru, Singapore, Malaysia, Vietnam, and other countries. 600 corporate advisors have access to the text, but the rest of us, you simple Americans, you know, by the people, for the people. No, sorry, you don't have a list to that. You don't have access to that. And what little has come to light, in addition to the corporate-flavored terms that would send American jobs overseas, decrease environmental and health safeguards, the TPP could undermine the ability of states or federal government to moderate escalating prescription drug, biological drug, and medical device costs in the public, said Ruben Berg, Secretary Treasurer of the Alliance. That includes limiting the government's ability to negotiate lower prices for prescription drugs for Medicaid and the VA. Alliance is joining with labor, public interest groups, and others in urging the Congress and President to make the process of these negotiations transparent. Gee, I think, you know, Elizabeth Warren called for that, too. Help wanted. Some say the Pentagon needs a haircut. Here's a job for you this Monday. By the way, listen up. This Monday, Budget Control Act, or sequester, requires that $109 billion be cut equally from military and non-military programs in fiscal year 2014. But in fiscal year 2013, the Pentagon got a free pass, and all the cuts fell on social programs. Let me say this once again. All the cuts, all the sequester cuts for 2013 fell on social programs. So what do you say we get the Pentagon, you know, to share the wealth? Hey, guys, maybe we can afford one less bomber and so we can feed, you know, another 50 million kids. What do you say? Genetically engineered trees. Friday, November 1st at 7 p.m., Global Justice Ecology Project and the International Campaign to Stop Genetically Engineered Trees. There'll be a teach-in and campaign-building workshop on the growing threat of genetically engineered trees and the future of forests. You heard about that before here. Genetically engineered trees, GE trees, pose an enormous risk to the biodiverse forests of the southeastern U.S. GE trees are being promoted for use in industrial monoculture plantations for timber pulp and bioenergy. GE trees, like the highly invasive flammable eucalyptus tree, are being pushed as climate solutions despite the enormous human health and ecological risk. Well, we've got three more minutes for the news, so let me leap ahead. By the way, as always, you'll be able to get all these details of the news that we want to share with you. If you go to averyvoice.com, you'll be able to see all this stuff. And let's see, along the West Coast, 28 signs that the West Coast is being fried with nuclear radiation. Polar bears, seals, walruses along the Atlantic the Alaska coastline are suffering fur loss and open sores. Wildlife experts are studying whether fur loss and open sores are detected in 9 polar bears in recent weeks is widespread and related to similar incidents among seals and walruses. The bears are among 33 spotted near Barrow, Alaska during routine survey work. Tests show they had epilepsia, alopecia, or loss of fur, and other skin lesions. There's an epidemic of sea lion deaths along the California coast. Island rookeries off the southern California coast. 45% of the pups born in June have died, said Sharon Mellon, a wildlife biologist for the National Marine Fisheries Service based in Seattle. Normally, less than one-third of the pups would die. It's gotten so bad in the past few weeks that National Oceanographic Atmospheric Administration declared an unusual mortality event. But again, on further to Fukushima, some of the very latest news. Here we go. Big Pharma has bought out a big meeting of the NIH. Congress spent some hours trying to understand the Internet. There's a real helpful thing there. And finally, in Fook News, Jeff Christensen, that's the Seattle aquarium biologist. We've got sea stars look like they're melting on the bottom. Amy Moreno, King 5 News, the same thing's happening in the waters near Canada. Nobody's sure why. caused from the environmental or perhaps driven by disease. Lisanna Larner, veterinarian, says, we often think viral when we think of CSAR disease, but we don't have a good idea of what's causing it. Just a few weeks ago, the population in Puget Sound looked healthy. The news has gotten good. They estimate close to half appear to be sick or dying. For decades, the 62-year-old horse breeder, Tokei Hosokawa, barely registered that his farm was just 40 kilometers northwest of Fukushima. Like several other farmers in Fukushima, he ignored a government order to exterminate all his horses and cows. After the accident, one of his horses gave birth. When I saw the foal get to its feet and start feeding, I knew there was no way I could leave. And January this year, he noticed that several among the 30 that remained, many foals had become unsteady on their feet. Within weeks, 16 have died of mysterious circumstances. Autopsy on four of the horses found no evidence of disease, and tests revealed cesium levels of 200 becquerels per kilogram, four times higher than the government's safety limit, but not high enough to immediately threaten their health. But ladies and gentlemen, you say you can go to averyvoice.com and get the more details. But now let me go to my first guest. I'd like to welcome the Democratic activist, campaigner, and web producer, Miss Diana Demarest. Welcome, Diane.
Oh, thank you very much for having me, Rick. I really appreciate it.
Well, you know, Diana, you're one of those wonderful resources we can call upon. I was wondering if you could give us your thumbnail sketch of what's going on for Florida Democrats these days.
Well, I think the Florida Democrats are very motivated. I think we've had enough of Rick Scott, obviously, and we want a pink slip Rick, which is pretty much the theme throughout the state. I think that they learned their lesson from 2012 of being apathetic and being mad at Obama and staying home, because that's what got us Rick Scott in the first place. And so I think that Democrats all over the state are working very hard to motivate people to go to the polls and motivate independents who, by and large, voted for Rick Scott back then, but I think are awfully mad about what he's done over the past 4 years.
Okay. Let me ask you this. We've got potentially a couple rivals vying for the Florida governorship, although there's only one declared candidate. I see the Palm Beach Post is ready to anoint Chris, the what they call him, the rock star. You know, I can't help but think that that's one of those backhanded compliments. Nobody wants to be called a rock star unless you're, I guess, 20 years old. It's not really a position of authority or responsibility. What's your take on this Palm Beach Post puff piece?
Well, you know, Nan Rich was a great senator, and she's a very smart lady, and she is a true blue Democrat. There's no doubt about that. She is all about Democratic values. Nan Rich has a major problem. She's not doing great in fundraising. The fact of the matter is Rick Scott will spend more than $100 million on this race. And unfortunately, and if it were up to me, we'd do public financing like they do in many states across the U.S. You know, in 18 months, she has managed to raise, you know, a little over $300,000. Here in Palm Beach County, you can barely, run a commission race on $300,000. And everybody talks about grassroots, 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 and grassroots is great. And I'm not downplaying grassroots by any means, because grassroots got a lot of people elected. When you're running a statewide in Florida, a grassroots campaign is difficult, because you have Dade, Broward, Palm Beach, which have the luxury of being blue counties. And you have the I-4 corridor, which has turned blue over the years, with the Hispanic folks moving into the territory, mostly of Puerto Rican descent. And you have the West Coast, Tampa, which is also blue. And then you have, of course, Alachua County, which is the college town. But pretty much the rest of the state, especially when you're talking about tiny counties like Columbia, and they're tiny. I mean, their DECs, or their executive committees for the Democratic Party, you know, encompass 18 people, whereas here in Palm Beach County we have well over 400. And Dade and Broward, you know, enjoy the same type of numbers. When you're doing a statewide race, you need money. You have to get your message out. You have to be able to shoot mail. You have to be able to run commercials. You have to be able to have people knock doors. And Nan Rich is a fabulous human being. Would I love to see her win? Sure. I think the reality is she can't raise the money. And I know that Charlie Crist is not exactly the bastion of progressive values. However, when you
are a very generous person.
Well, I mean, when you look at Charlie Crist, there are some good things he did do. You know, Charlie Crist vetoed SB 6, which was one of the worst educational bills that we ever saw come down the pike. He also vetoed the first vaginal ultrasound bill. He killed that too. He also gave automatic restoration rights to felons who served their time and their debt to society and allowed them to vote in 2008, much to the chagrin of the Republican Party. So as a Republican, you know, from my view, we could have done a hell of a lot worse. I think Jeb Bush was much more damaging than Charlie Crist was as a Republican. Charlie Crist is a Democrat. In my opinion, Charlie Crist was always a Democrat. He just had to put on the armor of the Republicans so he could win the gubernatorial back when he won the gubernatorial. If Nan Rich wins the primary, I, as well as many Democrats and many progressives in the state, would definitely support her. On the other hand, if she is not successful in a primary, I don't think we have much of a choice but to rally around Charlie Crist, because from where I sit in my perch, all I want for Christmas is a veto pen in the gubernatorial mansion. And if you thought the guys that were in leadership in the Republican House and Senate last session were bad, you ain't seen nothing yet. These guys coming in are far worse than what we already had, and all we need is a veto pen to stop some of their crazy stuff. I mean, these guys are passing crazy things. And, you know, if Charlie Crist is the candidate, you know, I don't think Democrats can afford to be apathetic. I don't think they can afford to stay home as they did in 2010. Bear in mind, in 2010, Alex Sink only lost by 61,000 votes statewide. We could have made that up in Dade, Broward, and Palm Beach County. In 2010, Palm Beach County had the worst turnout in the history of the county, and we're the third bluest county in the state. So I understand everybody's consternation about Charlie Crist, but if he's the guy, he's the guy. And, you know, I don't see where we have a choice.
Well, it's always good to hear a range of opinions. I can understand your stance. I think it's quite reasonable. But I'll just say that I disagree on that one. That's okay, though.
Well, I can understand it not being your first choice. I'm sure it's not a lot of progressives' first choice statewide, especially in this county. But your choice is this. If he becomes the nominee, stay home and cut your nose off to spite your face. Because at the very least, you get a veto pen. And here's the other reality. And again, you know, my problem with the Democratic Party has always been, and I'm a very active member in the Democratic Party. I'm on the Communications Committee for our Palm Beach County DC.
You're not throwing stones from outside, that's for sure.
You know, I am on their senior caucus. I am active in the Democratic Party. My problem with the Democratic Party, and this goes back to when Obama first got elected, when Rahm Emanuel called us a bunch of effing retards, if you remember that.
Oh, I remember quite well. They wanted us as long as they wanted us, and when they didn't, thank you very much.
Right. Well, and the problem with the party has always been is that they pat progressives on the head and go, yeah, go away. And so because the Democratic Party does not take progressives seriously, and they never have, and I'm not sure when they will, but...
I remember FDR.
You know,
I remember Wilson.
Well, that was a very long time ago, Rick. You know, the reality here is this. Debbie Wasserman Schultz, Senator Bill Nelson, and President Obama are going to endorse Charlie Crist. They're gonna, if he wins. They've left the OFA. You know, like him or hate him, Charlie Crist helped deliver the state of Florida to President Obama in 2012. And so he's going to be rewarded for that. That's reality. It's not, you know, my doing or my agreement or whatever. I'm just giving you political reality. And the political reality is that rank-and-file leadership in the Democratic Party will rally around this guy and expect the rest of us to do so. Now, progressives can get mad and progressives can stay home, but they'll end up with another 4 years of Rick Scott and a Republican majority. And I don't know that we can afford that after they've, you know, tried to decimate unions, tried to decimate their pensions, tried to decimate education, and quite frankly have done a pretty good job of it, and Will Weatherford leaving $51 billion of Medicaid expansion on the table in protest of the ACA. I think that Democrats can't afford to stay home. Even, you know, I kind of subscribe to the Bill Clinton rule of thumb here. In the primaries, you fall in love, and in the general, you fall in line. And unfortunately, as that may be to some progressives in the state, that's a reality that we're going to be facing this election in 2014.
Just a, I have to share a thought with you. If we only go with political leadership, I honestly can't call him a Democrat. If we go with political leadership that goes with the flow, that goes along and get along, that the moneyed interests support, we're not going anywhere but right. I mean,
well,
why,
you know,
in God's
Rick,
name would
some? Florida is we're not a progressive state. If we were Connecticut, Vermont, Maine, New Jersey, if we were a progressive state, I'd say we have a chance in hell.
I understand your point of view, but I do want to make a point. The label progressive, to me, is so often used as a pejorative, as a bludgeon, when if you scratch the average middle-of-the-road person, they would just assume that schools serve their purpose. They would just assume that people had access to their Social Security. They'd just as soon make sure that their foods were safe, that the union contracts, that contracts that they participated in, that those contracts were honored. So, you know, I think the term progressive, when used the way too many middle-of-the-road conservative Democrats use it, well, no one wants to be called the guys that hate America, which is what progressive means to a lot of people. But on the other hand, they do like their libraries. They do like food that's safe. They would like to be able to swim in the oceans. And that's what progressive values are. So
and
to
I
say
completely
progressive,
agree with you, but not
the way
only
Rahm Emanuel says a progressive, or to say, you know, environmental, the way, pick one, Joe Lieberman might say environmental. Well, no, nobody's in favor of that. No one's in favor of that at all. But on the other hand, what are real progressive values? Take away the label, clean air, clean water, schools that teach, libraries that are open, protection for mom, protection for grandma, that kids have access to care, that we don't throw the people out in the street, that those, well, you could call them Christian values as far as I'm concerned, those are values of real humans.
Well, Jesus was a liberal, after all, although the Republicans would never admit that. But
I'm not going to argue with
you there.
I think, you know, you see my point, though.
Yes, and I agree with you that the word progressive is used as a pejorative on our side. But even in addition to that, progressive is used as a pejorative on the other side, as well as liberal, as well as Democrat or Democratic. They're all pejoratives, you know, so...
Let me ask you a few lies, just for a second. Because,
sure.
You know, you made the point, and I think it's an accurate point. The way the Democratic Party writ large, or certainly the DL, the DCL, or whatever you want to call it, as
the DLC,
that part
the Democrat Leadership Council, which
I
think is gone.
The way they treat liberals is so different, is so completely different than the way the Republicans treat their activist caucus. And, you know, you look at the way the Tea Party has been embraced, that energy, that enthusiasm, that, you know, granted, now it comes with
cold money. It's different, though, Rick, because in the Republican Party, they punish their people that step out of line. We don't do that in the Democratic Party. We may see them pat us on the head and poo-poo us or laugh at us or whatever.
I'd say that when Rahm Emanuel called us all retards and that we were drug-crazed, we were trying to get the people who made us promises hold to their promises. There
but we weren't
one
punished. Our leadership positions on committees were not taken away. Our caucuses were not taken away. We were not primaried. I mean, Democrats don't do that to other Democrats. I've never seen, even in a progressive circumstance, where a progressive is running, where we actually, as a party, throw somebody in a race to screw the progressive out of the seat. That is something that is so fearful on the Republican side and is a standard practice. If you don't toe the line, we're going to throw somebody in and we're going to primary you. And these are strong-arm tactics that the Republican Party uses on their own that the Democrats do not do, that have been overt.
Ted Cruz and a handful of right-wingers stole the agenda from the moderates and walked away with it. And that's why the government...
And basically, the Tea Party, the Tea Publicans, as I call them, the Tea Publicans have, you know, minimized John Boehner as elite. I mean, he's shown no leadership. I think he's drunk most of the time, but that's besides the point. But he has shown no leadership. I mean, how many times has that guy had to bring bills to the floor that he had to pull because he did not, you know, they have this unwritten Hastert rule, the Hastert rule that says if the majority doesn't agree with it, you can't bring it to the floor. It seems like an insane way to govern, but this is the rule that he's adopted, and he's had to pull multiple bills because he could not whip these people to get them to vote his way. And so I think Boehner has been minimalized and trivialized and weakened, and he's showing his – I mean, let's face it, he won the speakership last time by 6 votes. So, you know, he's not a strong leader. And I think that the Democrats have a great chance in 2014 to not only win the governor's mansion back in Florida, but I think we have a great chance to win the House back in Congress. And I think that that is going to – be a big deal, and this is why Democrats, regardless of whether they like Charlie Crist or not, can't stay home. They can't stay home. If they stay home, then they can't complain when they're getting screwed, both in Congress and in Florida.
Let me take this in another direction. Especially here in Florida, you can't turn around, you can't drive to the store, you can't spend a day at work somewhere without appreciating the huge impact that immigration has on our state. Do you think the Democrats are going to propose significant immigration changes this coming year?
Oh, absolutely. I think the Democratic Party is committed. And I can tell you what we're doing here in Palm Beach County, Florida. Our wonderful and fabulous and progressive and the best supervisor of elections ever, Susan Booker here in Palm Beach County, she is permitted to register new citizens. She gets a table in the back of the room over here in Palm Beach County that allows her to register new voters who are sworn in. Most of those folks are Hispanic. I mean, we do have some Haitians and some other nationalities involved, but most of them are Hispanic. And because they're new citizens and they don't know our, you know, political system very well, they register as NPAs. And so one of the things we're doing here in Palm Beach County, which I suggest every county in Florida do, is tag with your supervisor of elections, find out who's getting sworn in as new citizens and who are newly registered. We're contacting these folks and saying, hey, this is the immigration debate in this country, and this is what these people are trying to do to you, and this is why you need to be a Democrat. And so,
well, you know, we've seen Senator Rubio feign support and then back off of the immigration issue. We haven't heard too much from our other senator. Do you think he's going to be involved in this campaign, or is he going to hold fire, let's say?
Are you referring to Bill Nelson?
Yes.
I think Bill Nelson is very committed to immigration reform. I think he has supported the president's position on immigration reform, and I think he's very involved in that since, you know, Florida has a very large immigrant population, whether it be from South America or Cuba or other countries that are coming here and becoming citizens. I think that this is a very big focus. I think immigration reform, because let's face it, you have people that come here legally. Some of them bring their parents and their grandparents or their children over illegally. So, you know, and I hate to talk about things in terms of legal and illegal because, you know, my own family is from Ireland and Scotland on my father's side and from Greece and Turkey on my mother's side. And they came through Ellis Island because I'm originally from New York and that's what you did. But when you're coming on a raft from Cuba, you know, that it's not the same type of a circumstance. So I think that – I think Senator Nelson is very committed to coming up with immigration reform. I think that Marco Rubio goes which way the wind blows. And he, as a former – his parents being former Cuban refugees, put forth this proposal, and the Tea Party folks went nuts. They were like, oh, you're a traitor, and you turned your back, and we don't want these illegals, and what are you doing, and all this stuff. And so because he wants to be the Tea Party darling, and because he wants to be on a presidential ticket, whether it be in 2016 or down the road, I think Marco Rubio, and you know, he's a consummate politician. The fact that Marco Rubio won as a Tea Party candidate sincerely cracks me up because when he was a, you know, Speaker of the House in the Florida House, he was certainly not a right-winger. He was more of a moderate Republican. And how he emerged as this Tea Party darling is, I crack up every time I see him speak because it's like this isn't Marco Rubio who spent all those years in the House. So he's really a chameleon candidate, and that's what people have, you know, on the Tea Republican side have not seen. They didn't follow his career when he was in the Florida House, and he was definitely not a Tea Party guy. He was definitely not a right-wing guy. He was a moderate Republican, somebody you could do business with.
Diana, let me ask you another question, an area that I know you have a great deal of expertise in, because I know you work not only in politics, but you also work in technology. You work in web technology.
Yes.
And, of course, we can't go very much further in this discussion without raising the issue of the Affordable Care Act and
right.
What is the news story of this last 3 days or so, the horrendous glitches that have prevented all those people from showing the Republicans that they're completely wrong. The complications or the glitches, whatever you want to call it, those of us who work in the industry are familiar with the fact that when you have multiple databases interacting, there's going to be a potential for problem. What's your take on these the issue of problems with the Affordable Care Act website? What's your take
on it? Okay, well, as you know, I've been in the website industry for going on 17 years, and we've done very complicated database applications for multinational corporations. And here's the number one problem I see with the ACA website. Number one, they put it on a server that is very old technology. Currently, you have something called cloud computing. I'm sure people have seen ads from IBM. I'm an IBMer, and I do cloud computing. You know, the advantage of the cloud is that a cloud server can see incoming traffic and go, okay, I'm getting hammered right now. Let me spin off another copy of this website and let me deal with the incoming traffic. And a cloud server has the capability of spinning off multiple copies of itself so that it can handle other people coming to get nailed, you know, on the, you know, that coming to nail the server to get their thing done. We didn't have it on a cloud computer, which we should have, a cloud server. We should have, we didn't, and I think that's coming. The secondary and the bigger problem is I've worked on many database applications that involved many moving parts and many pieces and many different departments of a corporation. You had basically four or five main contractors, CGI out of Canada, and you had this other guy dealing this piece, that piece, the other piece. So you had four main contractors. Under those four main contractors, you had 50 subcontractors. When you're dealing with programmers, I'm serious. They all hired this guy to do this piece, this guy to do that piece, this guy's going to write this piece. When you have 50 programmers, you might as well just jump off a building, because you will never get programmers to agree on anything. And if they're not communicating, and I think that's the biggest piece of this, is that you had four subcontractors or four main contractors and 50 subcontractors. Nobody was communicating with each other, and so they all were off in the silo. I did my piece works, and it worked great. But I, you know, and I watched the hearings. I mean, the hearings went on for 4 or 5 hours on C-SPAN.
I didn't get a chance to watch them.
Well, it was very interesting.
Really interesting your take.
Because they were basically saying, oh, but my piece worked. Well, did you make sure that your piece talked to this other guy's piece? Well, no, that was not my purview. And then the other guy would go, well, no, I didn't talk to that piece because my piece was this and it wasn't my
job.
Who
was the overall integrator?
Well, that's the friggin' problem right there. You had CMS, which is the government agency,
Canadian firm, yeah.
Which handles Medicaid and Medicare. They were the overall, but really nobody took responsibility. Somebody needed to be the overseer of the project overall to make sure everybody was communicating, that everybody's piece was talking to the other piece. Because I'm going to be honest with you, talking to databases across the web isn't really that complicated. I've been doing this for a long time. You send data and you make sure that, okay, I get an acknowledgement back from that database that you got my data, and we're cool. The secondary problem was that because nobody took responsibility for the overall project, nobody really cared about whether or not I'm getting $100 million, my piece works, I'm done. No, you're not. The third problem is that if you remember Obama on TV saying, hey, you're going to be able to go on the exchange and you're going to be able to shop just like you're at Amazon or go to Kayak to buy a ticket, remember that? 2 weeks before a live launch, somebody at CMS, at the government agency, made the decision to make people enroll first before being able to shop. 2 weeks
before
launch.
That's just a horrible decision.
It was a decision I certainly wouldn't have made. And in addition to all of this, nobody tested the overall system, or CMS actually had the responsibility of testing. Nobody tested the system from point A to point D to make sure all the pieces were talking to each other until 2 weeks before launch. So you did a major change order 2 weeks before launch and said, okay, instead of allowing people to shop first, enroll later, make them enroll first, shop later, bad mistake. And then you had them only do testing 2 weeks before launch. Testing should have been months. Each piece should have been tested for months and make sure this database, because you're talking about, A, it's got to talk to the IRS database to tell tell the IRS, hey, don't flag this guy with a tax because he enrolled. You have to flag Social Security to make sure the guy's information checked out. Hey, Social Security number, address, blah, 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 does that all match? And you also had a form called an 847 form, which is the form that was sent to the actual insurance company when the guy decided to buy. So here's Blue Cross or Billy Bob's Insurance, whoever it is, that got an application via the website. And when their application came through, the 847 form came through with a guy that had three spouses instead of one spouse and two dependents. So the form coding was wrong, so the insurance companies were getting these wacko forms that showed if a guy had five kids, he had five spouses instead of dependents. So, you know, you
Diane, let me ask you a question.
Sure.
Let me ask you a quick question. You know, those of us who've done database work, those of us who've been involved in, forms and form procedures, creating forms into a website. It's kind of a standard rule that you want to make this as painless a process as possible, ask the fewest amount of questions, give them the carrot first before you ask them the stick with all the questions. I cannot conceive of that being a small decision to insist that they log in first. Do you think that's a vendor-level decision? That sounds like a policy-level decision to me.
No, that was a management decision at CMS, and CMS really should not have made that decision because Obama had been doing his tour around the country selling the ACA, saying, hey, you're going to be able to log onto a website and you're going to be able, just like going to Amazon and going to buy a TV set. And when I go to Amazon, I don't have to log in. I can browse all the TV sets, and I can compare TV sets, and I can price TV sets, and I don't have to log in and have an account. I can do that all day long. I can go to kayak.com to buy a plane ticket and browse to my heart's desire to fly wherever I want and not have an account. Why this decision
exactly.
was made, and in these and in the hearings, and this was what was so astounding to me. Here was the vice president of CGI, who was the main contractor who wrote the front end of the system, say to the guys, you know, and the Republicans and really the Democrats too are hammering these vendors, as well they should be. They got $100 million, for Christ's sakes. Say, well, who at CMS made the decision? And they went down the line. Who made it? Nobody knew. Why doesn't anybody know who the guy is that said, let's flip this? You know, when you're talking about, and first of all, I could have done this for a hell of a lot less than $100 million had anybody knocked on the door, because, you know, transferring data from one system to another, there are ways to do that. There's standard formats. There's common to limited format. There's you know this. You're in the tech business. You know. You pass data to an app, and an app picks it up and says, okay, I understand what this data is, and it imports it into its system, and it sends an acknowledgement back to the original system that sent it that said, okay, everything's fine, I got the data. Well, nobody made sure that those transfers, and what I call handshaking, between
right.
databases happened. And the fact that nobody knew who made the decisions and who was calling the shot? Nobody took ownership of this, Rick, and that was really – there should have been a point guy that said, you are the guy that has to oversee all of these guys to make sure everybody's talking, everybody's communicating, and there, you don't do change orders 2 weeks before live launch. You just don't.
Diana, I got to thank you so much for doing this. I think you've given more insight for most people on this problem than I've heard in 2 weeks of discussion. Thanks so much. Unfortunately, I have to go on to my next guest.
It is always a
again,
pleasure
Diane.
To be here, Rick, and thank you for having me, and I'd love to be back again.
Okay. Thanks again. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, that was Diana Demarest, Democratic strategist and campaign consultant, very generous with her time to discuss Florida politics, and as you could tell, some really interesting insight as a professional on the database management issues raised by the ACA website. And now, ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to bring you Emily Dillick, publisher of the Progressive Press, and here she is from Spain. I'd like to introduce you to our audience. This is Emily Dillick, writer, publisher, essayist, author, international traveler, who is overseas in Spain these days, and I was hoping to have Emine give us a little bit of perspective from what she sees and hears both in Spain about things European, as well as what she hears when she looks back and talks to people about America. Emine, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for that introduction, by the way. I think I like the world traveler part the best.
Sure, sure.
My most favorite title. Everything is beautiful here. Of course, Spain is still struggling with its economy. It's been since 2009. They're going through the problems with the economy that swept through the entire Europe. But for some reason, you know, the German is doing well, the British English is doing well, but Spain is still lingering in there. The unemployment is really high. It was about 25% last year, but it's down to 17-18% right now. But the problems are continuing. Plus, there are scandals going on in the government with the, I don't know if you're familiar with the government structure of Spain. Spain is a constitutional monarchy, so it's very similar to Britain. So they have their regular Senate assembly representatives. They also have So monarchs, they're royalty. The people, the king and the princesses, and they basically, even though they have their own wealth, they still use tax money, you know, people's money to use their, on their expenses. And there was a huge scandal going on because I think they're cutting everything else. They're cutting all the public services, but they're not cutting anything on their expenses, royalties expenses. So there were huge problems. People were on the street protesting about that, and rightfully so. Of course, they're expecting, you know, if they're cutting our services, public services, and basically firing people from federal jobs, then they should be a little bit more tight about what they're spending as well. So that's what's going on currently in Spain. But the difference is because they have in Spain a really strong safety net, I think the people are less inclined to feel the sting of the economic problems, because when you compare it to United States, our unemployment is when it starts to go up around 7%, 8%, we are uncomfortable with it. You know, economy really shakes. And but here, all the way up to 17, 18 last year, like I said, it was 25% unemployment, especially the youth unemployment, the ones that are just graduating from colleges. They're still not feeling it strongly, the problems, because of the safety nets that were set in place in 70s and 80s. So, you know, the healthcare is, they have the nationalized healthcare, so that is available to anyone, no matter what. That's probably the difference I can see right now, that why there's not much rioting, or the country's not plunged into a civil war yet.
Sure, that's understandable. Well, it's good to hear they have something of a safety net, because as I'm sure you hear, there are interests who keep pushing for further cuts in our social safety net, what fragments remain. But first, before we get into that that larger issue, I wanted to get your take on what the Spaniards you talk to, or the Spanish media, is saying about our recent kickstart of the U.S. government.
To be honest with you, what I see, most of my friends, they're not very politically oriented, the locals are here, but they say they have still a very strong trust in American government and economy for some reason. Most of them expressed to me that America will never go down, or America will never bankrupt, which I was surprised to hear, of course, in a good way. So I think in general there is still this large trust of the largest and the most powerful economy in the world, and I'm hoping we'll keep it. But of course, you know, I really didn't like the caving of the Obama administration and Democrats. Now that there are going to be more cuts in Social Security and Medicare, that's what I understood from the recent negotiations. So, but the Spaniards, the locals here, they still think the America is the top economy and it's doing well. Comparing here, of course, our unemployment is about 7%, if I'm not mistaken. Now, the last from last month's unemployment numbers. So, 7% and 17-18% is a huge difference. So, I guess still maybe we bounce better. The I don't know if it is the system itself, the economic system. It looks like we bounce faster and better in a way, but bounce back. But I'm definitely not very pleased with the latest negotiations on reopening myself personally.
Does Spain use the euro, or do they use, I think, is it the real?
Euro. Yeah, the euro. They're in the European Union. They use euro, correct.
Okay. Another thing I was wondering, there's increasing fracking over in Europe. Pretty impacting in Britain, but the French just recently outlawed it. Are they doing fracking in Spain, do you know?
No, it's very, they don't have a lot of fracking going on in Spain right now. And I don't know if you're familiar with the location of the Spain. Spain is one of the highest sea level from the sea, after Switzerland, it's the second highest country as far as the elevation goes.
Uh-huh.
So, I don't think there are so much of going on in Spain. No, I haven't heard of it in the news.
Okay.
But if it is, of course, in European Union, if the European Union Commission, the environmental ministry, if they make the decision, all the countries that are inside the European Union, they all have to implement the same law.
Uh-huh.
So if it is something starting with France, and then if the European Union Commission, the Assembly accepts it, then it's going to be, you know, implemented and applied in every country. They actually like being in European Union.
Uh-huh.
My friends here, when I speak with them, I wasn't sure, and they told me that maybe they are weathering this financial crisis better because they are in the European Union, because they did get a lot of loans and, you know, money to feed into the economy, basically. So I think they, in general, there is more of a positive look. They are pleased with the idea that they are in the European Union.
Yeah, I was wondering, can I ask you a question or two about Greece? Greece is having, it seems, a lot of civil disturbances, and of course, there's that growing rise of the Golden Dawn. Do you catch much of that press?
Yes, there was a recent killing of a left-wing leader over there. Yes, they are, but my understanding is it is under control, at least the people themselves, because the Golden Dawn, the fascist neo-Nazis, they're about, I want to say, 15% of the entire population supporting them, which are really a fringe, you know, party. And when you look through actually entire European Union, Europeans, especially Western and Northern Europeans, they are more, you know, social democrats, and they're definitely more left-leaning than the fascists, because you know what happened in the Second World War. They
sure.
went through, you know, dealt with the fascism in a huge blow with the Nazis and Italians, Mussolini. So there is this extreme fear towards fascism, and they do understand what it means and what it can cause. So I think they are trying to keep it in control, but I know they were trying to pass new laws on it, to hate crime laws. I'm not sure of the exact results of it, but I know very well from my communications with my friends in Greece that they are aware of the danger, and they're trying to keep it under control.
It looks like we've at least tamped down the rush to war in Syria. Do you get much news there in Spain about the troubles in Syria, Turkish border issues? I know you are in touch with some folks in Turkey. What is the latest you've heard in Turkey from regarding the Syrian situation?
Well, the Syrian situation is, everyone is, especially the people other than the Erdogan's government, everyone else is happy that there was not a strike by the United States, and, for now. And but, of course, Erdogan is such a politician that he will go with the, you know, he'll change his mind and his speeches and rhetoric according to what's convenient. So now he was a big prop. He wanted the war. He wanted to attack Syria alongside with United States and Israel. But now, because United States backed up, and then Israel is not getting involved as much, or at least on the surface. So he is saying that he never wanted war, and you know, he's pleased that they are looking into international peaceful solutions, and they're trying to get involved with that. But of course, as you know, I don't trust his government, AKP.
I see. I was just going to ask you, as a consumer. You lived in the States, you live now in Spain. How are the prices for food in Spain?
Oh, prices are better, but of course, because the euro is a little bit higher than the dollar, it comes down to almost same spending for me, at least weekly, monthly, what I'm spending regularly on grocery shopping. But where you save a lot of money is they have a very efficient and inexpensive public transportation system. They have a great metro and a bus system that it's incredible. It's only €1.50, and you can go anywhere with it. You don't have to own a car. Actually, owning a car is more of a hassle than because there's a parking problem, you know, and they charge a lot of money. Insurance is really expensive. So I just really, you know, I've been in the United States, lived in the United States for 20 years, and I drove, you know, my car, and I really thought I was going to miss my car. I didn't ship my car. But I am really enjoying my freedom to not depend on my vehicle. Here, I can just take the bus. In front of our apartment, there's a bus stop, and then the metro is in walking distance everywhere. You can just go anywhere and everywhere, and it's very efficient, and it's very inexpensive. It's very timely. They're always on time. I don't remember ever waiting longer than 10 minutes. So it's incredible. It's very clean. I am really impressed with the entire public transportation system, I have to say. I'm very impressed with it.
What part of Spain are you in?
I am in Madrid. I'm at the Capa. I'm in the middle of the city, actually.
No kidding. City life. No kidding.
I really like it. It's very different than where I was before. You know, in Florida, I lived in a suburb. So we are enjoying, especially for my son, you know, as a teenager, it's to be able to just take the bus to your school so you don't rely on your parents. I think he's really enjoying it.
Oh, that's good. That's good. Are there any other international issues you've been thinking about lately?
Not really. And my focus is, of course, always on still the United States because my Spanish is not that great yet in order for me to be that involved in what's going on. I'm trying to understand, of course. But there are, you know, English and Spanish news, of course. So my focus is especially because of closing off the, shutting off the government, U.S. government, I was focusing on that last 2 weeks. And everything else is going good.
Let me ask you this then, since you've been following the news here closely. Do you think, and this is kind of one of the questions of the day, do you think that the Tea Party wing of the Republican Party has learned anything, or are they just going to dive back into the same mess come January, February?
Well, the learning thing is, learning lessons require you to be an insightful person. So I'm not sure. You know what I mean? Like, you have to have some kind of introspective personality to just look into and say, oh, you know, I need to learn a lesson from this. I don't think they function that way. And but what I see is within the Republican Party, GOP, there is going to be a blowback on them. It's already started. You know, there was infighting with Ted Cruz being, you know, really some of them were attacking Ted Cruz about his speeches and rhetoric in general. So I think Republicans in general learn their lessons to not rely on Tea Party. That's my take on it. I have a feeling maybe Tea Party will realize that they are really a minority and they're hurting their own party, political party. They're hurting Republican Party, GOP. So could be that maybe they'll have their own, you know, with Sarah Palin and Ted Cruz, they might create their own party as like a third party, you know, like the Greens we have on the left. So that could be the eventual end of it. But I think they're understanding now, the Republicans themselves within the party, the more rational ones, and then the Republican voters, that Tea Party has not been beneficial to them at all.
Well, they've certainly been good for the Democrats.
Correct. We love them. But it's very interesting that even though, you know, mainstream media they really do not cover most of these things in a more in-depth way, but the media such as yourself, more independent ones, or like, you know, our publishing Progressive Press, they you cover these things more in detail. And then, you know, we see that I have Republican friends. You know, I see their reaction on Facebook or social media, and they are really kind of fed up with the Tea Party. They're done with it. So I'm pleased with that result. But nothing good came. Nothing good came out of the shutdown. It's at least maybe the, you know, the generation of Tea Party will be the benefit of it.
You know, I was kind of surprised as the negotiations were ongoing that the Tea Party kept throwing up one old half-baked used idea after another. And I was really surprised when the last thing that they brought up was that old chestnut where an employer can prevent a woman from using birth control, obtaining birth control, obtaining birth control services. And I thought, you know, the fact that they're still raising that flag to me says that they're not really ready to leave that issue behind. They still want to oppress women come hell or high water if they can.
Of course not. I mean, the woman, the issues of women is their, the base on their ideology is, I think the way they read the Bible and the biblical way of looking at the politics is absolutely, I mean, they're not going to change it. It's their ideology, ideal base. They're not going to change that. It's not going to, I mean, it's going to go on and plus it's part of Obamacare. The affordable health care law, as you know. I'm going to call it Obamacare because I like calling it Obamacare.
Sure.
And, of course, they're vehemently against it. How many times now? 35, 40 times?
40. They try to, over, you know, 40 they, times.
Over 40 times they tried to, you know, defund it. And this whole thing, I mean, they shut the government because of it, because they didn't want to fund Obamacare, you know, the health care for our own citizens. And that's a part of it, the contraception and then the other health care, because the women, we used to pay more before. I don't know if you're aware of
this.
But our insurance monthly premiums were higher before, and now the Obamacare provided the you know, leveling of it, and then of course all this extra care that's going to be provided for women free, include, not, I don't like to say it's free because you're still paying, but it's included in it. You don't have to pay extra for it. And they're definitely against it. I mean, they're against abortion. They're against contraception. It's in their, and it's not only because it's their ideological base, it's also, it's in Obamacare. So they're just against it. And they're not going to change that. That's because maybe they believe they still have support for it. They have about, you know, evangelicals, about 35% of the U.S. population are evangelicals. So I am thinking they still think they have support from people that are against contraception for women and you know, abortion rights. So they have no reason, at least I see, or they don't, to change it. They're not going to change it.
It's just amazing to me that these people are prepared to keep running off that cliff again and again and again. You know, they're already a minority. Now they're a minority of a minority. And you know, they're working against immigration. They're working against women. You know, what group of humans do they actually like besides just evangelical Christians? It amazes me.
But even within the evangelicals now, I see a fraction that's happening, the libertarians, you know, don't forget the libertarians, who are against war and against defense spending. So there is that separation as well. I mean, that's one of the things that within the Tea Party that kind of got separated. So you're right, they're getting to be a smaller and smaller group, which is very good for our country, of course. And so I'm hoping, you know, coming 5-10 years, we'll totally forget about them.
You know, I can appreciate the shriller the better, the more they look like fools. It drives people our direction. I can completely appreciate that as a cynical political person. But, you know, I can't help but think, I'm so much a believer of the common interests of humanity in general, that when people are so monomaniacal and so intolerant, it's difficult to see good fruit from that particular poisonous bush. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Now, let me ask you one more question. I'm sure that many of your friends over there are tech savvy, use the internet, and I was wondering if the question of this kind of universal, ubiquitous spying has been discussed over there. What kind of take do you hear over there?
Yeah, well, actually, they are not as much as most of my friends are not even on Facebook. So although, of course, they know how to use the internet and they have an idea about social media, they're more social in real life. Like, they go out with their friends. I'm not saying we don't. I'm not saying Americans don't. I'm just saying that I think if there's a preference, it's sitting in front of a computer and chatting with their friends online or going out, they will probably go out. Because there are maybe in the bigger cities like metropolitan, like Madrid, it is the case. But I see more people on the street or on the cafes here than I have ever seen in West Palm Beach, for example. So that one thing. The other thing is, yes, they are... they are a little bit nervous in general about the sharing of their personal information without their knowledge, of course, as any normal person would. But it's not proven yet that the Spanish government has done anything like that, even though I have a feeling I'm sure it is. I'm sure they have done it, but I really didn't see anything on the news as far as the actual, you know, government itself doing any spying on its people in Spain. So they don't really have a lot of opinions on that. I don't remember having a lot of conversations on that. Unless I think if it's been... The more conversations here were about the economy and also the royal spending the money and the scandals of the princess, you know, using the taxpayers' money for her vacations and things.
Well, you know, you can't give a polo pony food stamps, you know?
Exactly. So the conversations we're having were more on that than actual, you know, spying on people and then the share, you know, extracting personal information without knowledge of the regular, you know, internet users. But yeah, the NSA problems is more of, I think, on the United States than here.
Okay. Well, is there any other final thing you'd like to share with the audience, or is that pretty much our fine report from the city of Madrid?
No, I'm glad to be on your show again. Thank you for the invitation.
No, it's our pleasure.
Enjoy your day. Thank you so much.
Are you still publishing your Progressive Press?
Yes, we are. We took a short break for the summer because of my move here, and we're just looking for new writers, and we're going to be restarting soon.
Well, we wish you the best of luck, and let us know. We'll help you publicize the issue.
Thank you so much.
Take care, Emily. And that was Emily Dillick from the city of Madrid, Spain, and also publisher of the Progressive Press. And now, ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to bring you direct from Wales, our good friend, a publisher of UK Progressive and also Worldview on YouTube, Mr. Dennis Campbell.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to welcome Dennis Campbell, publisher of UK Progressive, host and producer of Worldview. Dennis, welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Dennis, you bring a wonderful perspective. You're an expatriate living over in the UK. When you look back at this last month or so, what America's been put through, what's your takeaway, to use the common expression?
Well, I think the biggest takeaway is just one of utter disgust with the whole process, I think. You know, we've had so many opportunities to get it right and to work out some sort of a dialogue, but when you're dealing with you know, a group of people that would prefer to hold the entire nation and government hostage, I don't know what else you do. I mean, I'm just so fed up with the excuses that they use when, you know, it's just a very simple calculus here. They cannot stand the fact that the President of the United States is a black man. And all of this has been racially biased, racially related, and just despicable behavior by a group of Southern Dixiecrats who, you know, cannot get out of their own way and have absolutely not one patriotic bone in their body. They just want to see the entire nation dragged down into the cesspit that they've created.
You know, it strikes me as remarkable, even though a lot of us believe that the mainstream media, you know,
leans toward the center, if that's an accurate way of putting it, or at least tries to do a this side equals that side riff. It's amazing to me the softball questions that get thrown at these ideologues on the right, and simple, obvious questions just seem to go unasked.
Well, they throw the softball questions because that's what sells newspapers. That's what generates the discussion. I mean, I've been, you know, providing commentary for CNN International, Al Jazeera, BBC, ITV for years, and yeah, they're all heading down this wormhole of, you know, they want to make sure they can get people at the polar opposite so that they'll have a go in terms of, you know, going at each other, forget about the issue, forget about resolving anything. And, you know, the entire nation is built on, you know, who can say no, F you, the loudest and the hardest. And it is really, it's a disgrace. It's a disgrace to the profession. It's a disgrace to media. It's a disgrace to everything I watch. And then I got so fed up because I found myself, even with my own program at times, getting caught up in that trap. And, you know, that's part of why we took a couple of weeks off, just to sort of, you know, regroup and regather. We're not solving anything if all we're doing is adding to the conflict and the dialogue. We're not doing anything unless we're out there really explaining the story in more detail so that people understand that, no, this, just like climate change, is 97%, you know, good science, 3% bad science, yet everybody gets an equal seat at the table. This is the same thing. You've got 97% of the government wanting to operate and function, and 3% of the wackos out there getting an equal place at the table. Why? Because that means ratings gold every time Ted Cruz opens his foolish mouth, and it means anytime somebody fights him, and if they get, you know, vocally violent or even physically violent, ooh, even higher ratings as a result of that. And nobody gets the real story of what's going on any issue, whether it's healthcare, whether it's, you know, fracking, whether it's whatever the issue is out there. All you get are equal sides dug in and sticking to their talking points, and no one can move them off the talking points. I mean, it's absolutely despicable that not one journalist out there can take control of an interview, call a spade when they're on their talking points, and get them to actually say something that is of value and of importance.
Now, one of the things that I've been, to say that I'm disappointed with the mainstream media is to really understate my case. But for just one, for instance, you know, there's been quite a bit of hot air spewed about the last few days about what is basically being characterized as the catastrophe of the rollout of the ACA website. Now, it seems to me that anybody with a lick of technical expertise has to appreciate the fact that trying to lash together a bunch of governmental and insurance databases is a technical nightmare. And given the moving target that it's been for the last year, are the states in, are the states not in, the constant flux in terms of insurance rate change, and I think you have to appreciate the fact that there's an ingrained bias against this working by a lot of corporate stooges, who would be surprised that there's some bugs in the soup. What about you? What do you think?
Well, you know, any new product launch is going to have bugs. This has been, much more than one would have expected. And, you know, it is something to be taken very, very seriously. That said, go back to the last major healthcare rollout that the United States experienced. That was Medicare Part D. It was just as disastrous. It was just as much of a cluster, you know what. And yet you don't hear any of that. Going back to what I said before, you know, part of my biggest problem with this is the blatant deception and blatant talking points that are being used by people like Hannity and others. I mean, he's been fact-checked, but those facts don't get out. I mean, there's a Slate magazine writer who came out and said, look, you know, not only they had three people that were guests on the show, every one of them was basically lying. And one guy said, well, I've had to fire people because of Obamacare. Well, he had less than 50 employees to start with, so Obamacare had nothing to do with why he had to fire people. There was another person that was caught, basically saying, well, I've got to pay $300 or $400 a month now in premium. I've got this premium, quote, sticker shock. Well, you know, what they don't talk about is the fact that they get all these tax credits and rebates as a result of it. And it turned out, instead of paying $300 or $400 a month, she'd end up paying something like $220 a year. And, you know, the misinformation machine funded by the Koch brothers is out there in full force and in full throat to make sure the other 25 states don't wake up and realize that being handed Medicare money to help them roll this thing out, they'll do anything to fight it and anything to destroy it. So it begs the question, what is it about the Republican Party that does not want poor people to have health care?
Well, you know, another thing that comes to my mind, because, you know, there's, shall we say, that the dust-up of battle is one problem, and, of course, the horse race is what the mainstream media covers. But, you know, I like to pull back and take a look at the big picture. And, you know, you have to wonder, the Republicans overreached so badly when it came time to when they were purging the voting rolls. And it clearly looks to, like most people, that they're overreaching here. They're blocking. They're obstructing. They're doing everything they can to make this president an abject failure. And, you know, you have to wonder, are they really going to end up creating the monster that they're trying to, quote, protect us from? They're overreaching, it looks like to me. And what other constituency do they have besides angry white males with a religious and gun fixation? It's just, who the hell are they playing to, you know?
Well, they're certainly not playing to women. I mean, I've been watching the McAuliffe race in Virginia, where, you know, McAuliffe has a 20-point lead over Cuccinelli because of Governor Ultrasound and the radical pronouncements of Cuccinelli against anything to do with birth control, abortion, or any women's reproductive rights. So, I mean, gee, what a surprise. That's coming home to roost. The biggest problem we have in taking back control of the House of Representatives and getting anything done is the 2010 census. That has thrown such an enormous monkey wrench into the process because these mostly Republican-controlled states have redistricted and gerrymandered every one of those districts in such a way that they are safe. There's only really about 20 to 25 seats that you can really look at and say they're in play. Everybody else is in a safe Republican district or in a safe Democratic district. And, you know, I don't know how you fix that. That's going to be the big issue, not just of 2014 or 2016, 2018, right up until the next census in 2020. Yeah, I'm almost of a mind to say, let them destroy it, so then finally people will wake up and see. But the demographic time bomb keeps ticking. I was listening to, Raphael, he's a New York representative, and he said something startling. He said 5,000 Hispanic Americans each and every day turn 18.
Wow.
All right. So think about that. I mean, that's an enormous number of people every year. Do you think these young people are ever going to vote Republican? No, they're not. So the only way the Republican Party can stop them is to keep them from getting the identification or getting on the voter rolls, and that will not work because the outrage will be there no matter what. I mean, they all hate Ted Cruz, and, you know, he's one of them, and
yeah.
It's just a absolutely losing proposition all around no matter who is on the ticket. I mean, Chris Christie is going to lose the women's vote because he's so bombastic and rude and crude. You know, Rand Paul, I mean, his past is going to be vetted, and that's going to come up, and all the crazy things he's done. Ted Cruz, do you need to say anything else? That leaves on the other side, Jeb Bush. Really? Are we going to go for a third Bush again? Looks like we'll go for a Clinton, but I don't think after his older brother, we're going to even think about looking at, you know, a Bush for president. So it's just an insane situation, and it's not getting any better.
One of the other things I wanted to ask you about is, you know, fracking is one of those issues that has been a real thorn in the side, both to the environmental movement and to our friends in corporate America. Why can't they just roll this thing through? Why can't they get the approvals that they want? But when I spoke to you last time about fracking, you mentioned an alternative issue, a related issue that's being confronted over in Britain. Was it some kind of a coalification, or what was that? What was that?
Yeah, the unconventional coal gasification is what it's called, and basically, it's fracking without the water going down into the coal seams and injecting explosions underground into old coal mines to release methane. Methane has always been the danger of coal mining. It's why you sent a canary down into the coal mine, because they would react to the methane gas faster than a human being would. And if you saw a dead canary, everybody ran like hell to get out of the mine because they knew that they had hit, you know, a pocket of methane gas. The problem is that most of the coal beds, you know, here in England and Wales and across Scotland have been mined as far as they should be mined. And what everybody is saying, all of the conservationists and others are saying, you want to keep at least two-thirds of whatever is underneath the ground under the ground. We're dealing with all kinds of things that can bubble up into the aquifer. It's a very complicated, pressure in, pressure out situation, keeping the water levels free of methane. Because once methane is in there, there's no cure for it, and there goes your water supply completely. So it's not even the hypothetical of, gee, if you drill down through, as in fracking, this could very simply and very easily destroy it. Plus, the illegal chemicals that are being used. We've got a situation in Australia, in the province of Queensland, where a company went and did this without permission. They released a number of chemicals, and the whole operation has been shut down. Yet people are using that operation, they're claiming it was a success, and they're using that as the basis for additional gasification here in the United Kingdom. There's a remarkable woman in Scotland by the name of Mel Kelly, M-E-L-K-E-L-L-Y, and your listeners should look her up on the internet. We did an interview with her where she explains the coal gasification process, and then we also had the words of the actual CEO of the coal gas company, clearly not knowing what it was he was talking about, but explaining there's nothing to worry about, but of course there is something to worry about, and people are getting very, very concerned because they're in the UK very closely aligned with the Tory government, the current Tory government, and they're trying to rush this through. Now, we're seeing a number of local authorities standing up to this government and saying no to the issuance of permits for test bore drills. So we've had 4 out of 5 successes in the last month, and these are, you know, small village councils, but they're still significant because they're sending a no message. The Balcombe protests down in Sussex County in the southern part of England was very successful in getting Quadrilla to abandon their drilling there. And as they abandoned, we saw this green chemical going down into the waterways. And it was another example where industry promises the world but cannot deliver the goods when it comes to it. So it's a fight that is ongoing. It's like you're playing a game of whack-a-mole because they've got so many more resources and so much more money and so much more spin, and so many of the government's top ministers, including the Prime Minister and the Chancellor, have very, very close personal ties and investments in this industry. It's really about to explode in terms of people finally waking up, understanding what it is and saying, no, I don't want that in my backyard or anywhere that it could affect the water supply here.
Let me ask you, with France just outlawing fracking, has that had any impact on what's going on in the UK?
I think what it all does is every time France, Poland has also stepped up, Bulgaria, a group of people went into a field, a group of villages, 400 villages, and basically stopped the equipment from going on to a site and starting to drill. The more I won't say civil disobedience, but the more people awaken to the fact that this is a very, very bad, very, very dirty source of energy, despite the propaganda effort, you're starting to see people are taking a second look. I mean, we just had this past summer, JP Morgan come out and say they would not do any more funding of coal projects for a lot of the reasons that we're talking about with Frank. Yeah, they're not going to fund it. And when the money people start to walk away, everybody starts to take a step back. I'm convinced, as are a number of people in FRACOFF and several of the other organizations, that the pressure that is being brought to bear, the amount of time it takes in the permitting, the general go-slow methodology now of the local authorities as opposed to the Tory government, which wants to fast-track everything, these are all good things for eventually bringing this to a halt, because this unconventional gas exploration is just an absolute disaster for the ecology. Came out today about the death of the oceans, and Robert Hunziker, who's written a similar article for us, and we've talked about it on Worldview Show. They were talking about this guy who had taken a huge transoceanic journey. And one of the things that was missing this time around was the birds. And there were no birds because there were no fish. And there were no fish because, you know, it was only the stuff that was being, you know, done by the commercial fishermen who were catching everything. And they were only keeping the tuna, and basically all the other dead fish were being thrown back. There's major changes in coral reefs. There's major changes in water temperatures. I mean, we're sitting here in our third day of tropical-style rains and temperatures, approaching 70 every day. And it's the 22nd of October that you and I are having this conversation. At a time when we should have temperatures every day at least in the 50s, if not in the 40s. So there's something very strange going on with our climate, and nobody is paying attention to this.
Let me take us in another direction entirely, because I hold your point of view as very very informative for us. Do you think that this Western fallback from the rush to war in Syria, you think it's going to hold?
I don't know. Syria is such a nasty place. I mean, we had John Kerry here in the United Kingdom talking about it, and about the only thing he said you can count on is the fact that you've got two sides that will always be fighting each other, and they will continue to fight each other no matter what agreements are reached, no matter what happens. And unfortunately, it's the people who are going to continue to suffer. There's no easy answer there. You don't want to certainly get involved in another war in that part of the world. Syria is becoming, you know, if you listen to Netanyahu and Israel, a puppet state of Iran. If you listen to the U.S., it's a dangerous state where if we, you know, give too many arms, we don't know who we're arming, or we could be taking ourselves back to Afghanistan and the 1980s when we armed the Taliban, thinking they were our heroes because they were fighting the Russians, and we saw how that worked out. Syria is just a depressing place at this particular point in time to even think about and look at, because nobody's in control. I don't think Assad is in control. I think his military and his generals are in control, but everybody's basically fighting for their lives right now.
One last topic I'd like to raise with you. We've seen recently some blowback from the U.S. NSA spying on the president of Brazil. Mexico's been spied on, and the Snowden revelations are continuing to tumble out thanks to the good offices of Mr. Snowden and WikiLeaks support. One of the few countries who has stood with the U.S. in their spying is the U.K. Is there an organized opposition to this ubiquitous spycraft in Britain?
Not really. You know, there are a number of people who have, you know, done what France did. They've raised the alarm. They've spoken, you know, how outrageous it is that, you know, the revelation came out yesterday. There was something like 70 million phone conversations had been swept up in France by the NSA. I think it's only going to get worse. I think you're only going to have this is turning into a death by a thousand cuts, and I really think it's going to be a very difficult situation, not just for this president, but it's been, you know, part of the American security apparatus now for far too long. And you know, if anything, we're finally starting to talk about something other than shutdown. And you know, as these stories dribble out, my understanding, at least according to Glenn Greenwald, who's the journalist who has seen everything, is that there is far more damaging stuff to come, and I wouldn't be surprised by anything that comes out of this one.
Well, sir, I want to thank you so much and wish you the best with your Worldview project and, of course, with UK Progressive. I hope you do enjoy your R&R, and thanks so much from this side.
Oh, my pleasure, and, you know, we'll do this again soon, and hopefully it'll be more of a dialogue. I feel as though I've got to get as much in as I can every time we begin one of these discussions.
Well, thank you so much, my friend. This is Dennis Campbell of UK Progressive and Worldview. Check him out on YouTube. Thanks so much, Dennis. Bye-bye.
So another one of our interviews with Mr. Dennis Campbell, thoughtful, progressive activist, publisher, Worldview producer and host. Definitely a show you should check out on Facebook. I also want to mention these shows are solely funded by Imagineering Productions. If you need website work, if you need SEO, you need an update to your site, you need pay-per-click services, let us know. You can get to us through the station. You can contact me directly. You all know my email address, janhuss@bellsouth.net. And I want to also urge you to tune in to our fellow progressive broadcasters on the web. Miss Gwen Holden Berry and her show, Here Be Monsters. It's on Blog Talk just before us from 6 to 7. I also want to mention Brian Stetton and his show with Ruth Ann, Progress Toward Democracy. Miss Anita Stewart and her show, Wise Woman Media. Susan Nylon out of the Sarasota area, both broadcast over air and on the web. Susan Nylon with the Nylon Report. Sita Bigwheel, the Sita Media Show out of the Melbourne area, Harriet Lerman, the Voice of the People, and of course our good friend Rob Abston and his show Smile, which I understand is coming back on the air very soon. So make sure you tune into these people, support them, support their sponsors. Without your help, these shows couldn't go on. There, so many of them are works of love, lots and lots of effort goes into these. The show may be on for an hour or 2 hours, but you probably would not believe the days and days of work that goes into each of these broadcasts. So support us as best you can. Okay. One more news item before we have our final guest of the evening. This is a story that goes completely hand in hand with those revolving door stories we hear too often, where generals or bankers, one day they're appearing on Wall Street or they're appearing at the Pentagon, the next day they're appearing in big business. With the same information that they had when they were regulators. This is a story about Big Pharma, which paid the FDA to have a series of hearings so that they could come up with a plan. Wait to hear this. It's amusing. A scientific panel that shapes the federal government's policy for testing the safety and effectiveness of painkillers was funded by major pharmaceutical companies that paid hundreds of thousands of dollars for the chance to, and this is the kicker line, affect the thinking of the Food and Drug Administration, according to hundreds of emails obtained by a public records request. The email shows the companies paid as much as $25,000 to attend any given meeting of the panel, which has been set up by two academics to provide advice to the FDA on how to weigh the evidence from clinical trials. A leading FDA official later called the group an essential collaborative effort. He bet he did it with a straight face, too. Patient advocacy groups said the electronic communications suggest that regulators have become too close to the companies trying to crack into the $9 billion painkiller market. FDA officials who regulate painkillers sat on the steering committee of the panel, which met in private and co-wrote papers with the employees of the pharmaceutical companies. The FDA has been criticized for failing to take precautions that might have averted the epidemic of addiction to prescription drugs, including OxyContin and other opioids. These emails help explain the disastrous decision the FDA's analgesic division has made over the last 10 years, said Craig Maton, the Columbus, Ohio attorney who made the public records request to the University of Washington. Instead of protecting the public health, the FDA has been allowing the drug companies to pay for a seat at a small table where all the rules are written. Even as the meetings were taking place, the idea of FDA officials meeting with firms that had paid big money for an invitation raised eyebrows. In an email to organizers, an official from the National Institute of Health worried whether arrangements had been made to look as if private meetings were a pay-to-play process. FDA officials did not benefit financially from their participation in the meetings, agency said, but 2 days later, they went on to work as pharmaceutical consultants, and more than this, the critics say the emails portray an agency that, by allowing itself to get caught up in a panel that seemed to promise influence for money, had blurred the lines between the regulators and the regulated. Blurred? That's putting it generously. In a statement, the FDA said, "We take these concerns very seriously," he said, barely stifling a laugh. "But," it said, "we are unaware of any improprieties associated with the group." They were shocked to find gambling going on in that room. Douglas Throckmorton, a deputy director of the agency, said, "The strict rules of transparency and funding apply to these private-public partnerships the agency engages in, and these efforts are important for the government and the industry. But the group in this case was not initiated by the FDA," he said, "and so was a private partnership to which those rules did not apply." Hey, these are places for us to have these discussions, Throckmorton said. This group was set up as a private group. A group is organized by two medical professors, Robert Dworkin of the University of Rochester and Dennis Turk of the University of Washington. And the emails, for the most part, describe their efforts at financing and organizing the group's meetings. The two professors received as much as $50,000 apiece for the meeting, money that went to their academic research accounts and paid for research assistant and expenses, or to cover a small percentage of faculty effort, they said. At one point in the emails, they said that they receive an honoraria of $5,000 apiece for a four-hour meeting at a hotel near the FDA offices. Meetings typically held around the Washington metropolitan area are focused on the best methods for measuring the effectiveness of painkillers. The intent was to help everyone develop better drug trials, Dworkin said in a phone interview. He and Turk responded to questions via email as well. A spokeswoman for the Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America, an industry group, declined to comment, saying the organization was unfamiliar with these emails. They do nothing. And they didn't even say it with a German accent. Exactly how to judge when a painkiller is more effective has been a long-running problem for drug manufacturers. And they believe that some of their products are effective, but that their benefits are missed in standard clinical trials. One goal of the group was to design chemical clinical trials to illuminate the benefits of new drugs that might be missed in standard tests, avoiding what the academics call false negatives. Just one second. Okay. Bob Rappaport, chief of the FDA's analgesic division and an attendee at many of the meetings of the group, did not respond to emails or phone calls. He's in an undisclosed location. But he has touted the influence of the group by the acronym IMPACT. A 2007 PowerPoint presentation he put together was called The Impact of Impact, and recognize the group's influence on FDA thinking. The presentation describes the committee as a wealth of opportunity for communication, as well as wealth, that was advancing the science and approving new analgesic drug products. While science was the subject of the meetings, the subject of money runs through the... Even for a pharmaceutical company, the $20,000 price for an invitation to a Washington meeting seemed somewhat high. And with that, ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to pause because we do have our final guest of the evening, Mr. Frank Day. So let me bring him on. Mr. Day, welcome.
Wonderful. Good. How are you doing?
Very good, sir. Very good. We certainly appreciate the fact that you were kind enough to call in after a day of politicking in Orlando and a long, long drive back home. Frank, tell us, what's the highlights of the meeting that those of us who couldn't attend need to know?
My goodness, Governor Rendell's speech last night, as soon as he stepped stage, I wanted a script of it so I could read it all over again. The man had a phenomenal story of success, where he came from in politics, and just an inspiring story for Democrats across Florida.
Excellent, excellent. And what were some of the other highlights, sir?
Well, we had various candidates. Of course, Nan Rich was given center stage at least two or three different times through the weekend. And we heard from the Attorney General candidate, and excuse me, I just walked in off the road from driving all day just minutes ago, literally. But William, let's see his name, William Rankin from Fort Lauderdale has just within the last week or so put together a campaign for CFO. And was given an opportunity in the closing session this morning to address the entire body, and has a very impressive resume, having been a military Army veteran actually, and served with CID, that's a Criminal Investigations Division, and specializing, I believe it was, in fraud, and. He has a very impressive resume. We have got a slate of statewide candidates that are extremely impressive.
Well, that's excellent. That's excellent. Is there any word on whether there will be a Democratic primary for governor?
Governor Crist didn't announce and was only giving, of course, running through the crowds, especially at last night's dinner, meeting and greeting, and was well received everywhere I saw him, but never made any announcement. Wasn't included in the major presentations, but was allowed to present to the various clubs and caucus meetings that went on, it seemed, endlessly. And I've got to say, this was probably the best put together and organized annual convention that I've seen in the 6 years that I've been involved.
That sounds really good.
I've got to give Chairwoman Allison Tant just a tremendous shout out, and her staff, Scott Arsenault, especially Nick Polito, the hardest working man in the Democratic Party, in my opinion, right now. Good gracious, my hat's off to you, gentlemen. And Madam Chairwoman as well.
So I guess you've got quite an interesting story to come back and take to your Democrats. I didn't get a chance to announce. You have so many impressive titles, sir. You're chairman. You're of a county party, right? Of county DEC.
Yes.
You're also.
Yes,
or go ahead.
I am also District 1 Director for the Florida Democratic Party's Small Counties Coalition, which, by the way, is the largest voting bloc still in the Florida Democratic Party, we're proud to say. And just today we had in the closing session, the State Executive Committee, actually, in the comments section at the end, had a new organization that wanted to start up, and it appears is going to be joining with us. A Red County Alliance that will be joining with us and working in concert with the Small Counties Coalition. So that will strengthen both organizations tremendously. But the next title that I hold was I had the distinction in the meeting that we had in March, I believe it was. The reorganizational meeting last January, I was elected by the chairs of Congressional District 1 to serve as chair of Congressional District 1, and then was later nominated by Chairwoman Tamp to serve on the Judicial Committee for the state.
Well, sir, you've been in the trenches for a long time. What is your take on the electoral chances of a Democrat this coming gubernatorial race?
Oh, goodness gracious. It is extremely good. Let's see. Rick Scott's chances, I think, of re-election right now are extremely low. Even holding what's estimated to be in the final hour, $100 million campaign to run against a Democrat. You just can't buy the voters of Florida with $100 million. There's been too much hurt. Rick Scott's accomplishments were laid out rather well in today's closing ceremony, and there's just no overlooking the man's accomplishments in 4 years. He's probably the best organizer the Democratic Party has right now in the state of Florida.
What was that? I'm sorry, I missed something there.
I said Rick Scott is
that's
bar none the best organizer of the Democratic Party in the state of Florida right now.
The certainly the best friend the Democratic Party has, right?
That's a fact. That is an absolute fact. His accomplishment while hurting Floridians, and really, I'm really reluctant to make light of the pain and suffering that the various sectors of Florida, the women of Florida, have been set back, and under another administration of Rick Scott will even go be set back further. The voting rights of Floridians across the state have been under just total attack by Rick Scott's administration these last 4 years, and of course with his partners in the House of Representatives and the Senate, controlled by both by Republicans. And the voters of Florida, I think the vast majority of the voters of Florida have had enough pain at the hands of Rick Scott and his administration.
Tell me, did we hear from some of those fantastic progressive legislators we have heading up to Tallahassee to work for us?
Yes, we did. We heard from Minority Leader Mark Fafford, and he is really jazzed. We have a new candidate that is recently announced for Congressional District 2 over in Escambia, South Santa Rosa, in Jeremy Lau. He ran a really, really strong campaign with, about 12 weeks, I think, total, somewhere around there, against Tea Party Mike Hill. And, of course, he came up just a bit short, but he set the stage to show Democrats across Florida in tough districts that it could be done. And the way what could be done was by a statewide effort from counties all across Florida pitching in to help a remote race like this. Thus, the Amanda Murphy race that came about successfully, I might add. Myself and two activists out of Tallahassee, John Hedrick and Herbie, and please, Herbie, forgive me, I just don't remember your last name at this moment. But we drove to Pasco and worked six walking lists after driving all day.
Wow.
I say all morning. I left my house that Saturday morning at 3:35 a.m., picked up Herbie and John in Tallahassee. By 7, we were on our way to Pasco County, got there and engaged 280 Democrats through six neighborhood lists that they had prepared for us. Finished about 7 p.m., had dinner, and drove straight home that same day. So that's how you win races. Everybody, activists across Florida, pitch in to these remote areas and just make it happen. We go door to door and get these Democrats to the polls.
Well, Frank, you are a Democrat's Democrat, sir, and we appreciate the hard work that you and so many do to try to turn this state around so that it actually serves its citizens instead of dining on the citizens. I know you're going to join me for another show in the not-too-distant future where we talk about standing on the shoulders of activists who've been in the trenches for decades, and I think you probably qualify there yourself. How long have you been working in Democratic politics, sir?
I have been active in Walton County politics. I believe it was, I started without getting involved in county politics with the Obama administration in 2008. I was moved by a comment my wife and I were by Oprah Winfrey, asking on one of her afternoon programs to take a look at this young man she's about to introduce, as she said, and outwrought young Senator Barack Obama from Chicago. And she interviewed him throughout that program, and I was impressed with him. And then over the months that followed and his building campaign, I hooked up with online, set up a little phone banking operation right here at my desk where I sit right now. Bought time, minutes on Yahoo, and set up an online account, and I did phone banking out of Tampa, right here in my living room and in my office in Northwest Florida for Barack Obama's campaign in 2008. After that victory, I was jazzed up at a victory party hosted by a good friend of mine and restaurant owner in Seaside, Dave Roshkov at the Button Alley's restaurant. And after which, then I got involved in the local Democratic Party in early spring of 2009, and it just hasn't stopped since then.
Well, thank you so very much. I can't thank you enough after a day-long campaigning down there and a long drive. Thank you, sir, and I hope you have a really nice rest for the next couple of days to make up for this hectic weekend you must have had. Thanks again.
Thank you, Rick. I certainly appreciate this opportunity.
Okay, you take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Okay, folks, that was the illustrious Frank Day, a Democrat's Democrat, a man who works so hard to make sure that progressive Democrats get elected in this state. And against all odds, it happens again and again. Good Democrats do get elected, and people are prepared to work very, very hard. I do want to bring you this last little segment. These are two quotes from Ed Snowden, who is talking about the efforts to bring the truth out. Here we go. Let's see here. There we go. Mr. Snowden is right here.
This is about a trend in the relationship between the governing and the governed in America that is coming increasingly into conflict with what we expect as a free and democratic people. If we can't understand the policies and programs of our government, we cannot grant our consent in regulating them. As someone very clever said recently, we don't have an oversight problem in the U.S. We have an undersight problem.
And now this little musical tribute. Take a listen to this, and I hope to hear from you next week. This is Rick Spezak, News Director of Progressive News Network. Thanks so much for joining us, and we'll talk to you very soon.
I don't want your millions, mister. While you enjoyed a life of ease, you've stolen all that we built, mister. Now our children's star and free. So
I don't want your millions, mister. I don't want your diamond ring. All I want is the right to live, mister. Give me back my job again.
Think me dumb if you wish, mister. Call me green or blue or red. This one thing I sure know, mister. My hungry babies must be fed. Take the two old parties, mister. No difference in them I can see. But with a farmer labor party, we could set the people free. So
I don't want your millions, mister. I don't want your diamond ring. All I want is the right to live, mister. Give me back my job again.